Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Endurance Chat. I am Floodman11, and joining me on this blustery Australian evening, I have Cookie Monster FL. How are you going?
I'm going well. How are you going?
It's cold, and it's windy, and I hate it, but we're talking about sports cars, so it's kind of okay. Only kind of.
It's great okay, because it was the 24 hours of Le Mans that we're talking about, I believe, right?
This is true, and thank you everyone for being a little patient with us. It has been 3 weeks since Le Mans happened, and like, I think it's fair to say that we all just needed a little bit of a break. I did. I definitely needed a little bit of a break. So sorry about that, and we'll return to our normal, like, semi-fortnightly, I guess we do these now, schedule soon, I guess. So thank you for being patient. But Le Mans,
we're
right?
We're trying to keep up. I mean, yeah, there's been even a couple of few events from other series that we're going to need to talk about otherwise. But yeah, we're all Le Mans right now. We haven't done this yet. So there's a lot to digest, if I could say that correctly.
And that's probably one of the other reasons why it's taken us so long to put this together, because there's just been so much that's come out of Le Mans, not necessarily maybe because of what was happening on the track, but sort of what was happening around the on-the-track action. But we'll try and cover off everything. If there's something that we missed, you can get angry at us in the comments or, you know, verbally in the Discord at some point. Or, you know, just send us an MP3 file of you raging at us. That's fine, probably.
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. That would be preferred. Then we can absolutely throw that up and potentially mock you. I don't know.
Sounds like a good time.
So
yeah, let's start at the top. So qualifying and practice for the Le Mans 24 hours was, as we said, 3 weeks ago. And to everyone's surprise, Toyota smashed it out of the park, and they were a few seconds ahead of the field, and everyone was like, oh my god, that's amazing. Except for everyone who was like, but hang on a second, weren't there regulations that were meant to make it more equal? It was an interesting build-up because it was kind of just what everyone expected. And it, yeah, I'm not really sure what to make of the build-up to Le Mans. Like, in years past, it's been a big question of, you know, who's going to have the pace over 24 hours, who's going to win. But this year, like, the build-up was, as we said in the preview, I think, Toyota versus Le Mans. Yeah, did you get any sense of any other sort of things throughout the build-up, or was it just the big headline of Toyota versus Le Mans?
Ever since test day, no. I thought we were going to potentially see some extreme, or not necessarily extreme, but some maybe extra things that we didn't really see from the privateers, maybe more low downforce on the SMP with higher gear ratios, meaning they would have a lot higher top speed, so giving more variable. But I mean, really looking at how it was, you really kind of thought, okay, well, even if Toyota dial it back, you know, plus 3 seconds, which you would assume would definitely get you within whatever range they need to be fast and within regs, they're still going to just blow out the privateers, and including the fact that they are plus one on fuel. They do faster pit stops, and they probably navigate traffic much more safer and faster, they're just going to walk away with it. And there's no visible advantage that the privateers have anywhere on the track.
Yeah.
So that was where I was at.
Yeah. And I mean, EOT and the consequences of EOT have been talked to death, both in the lead up and since Le Mans. And I think both you and I have had this discussion many, many a time about why EOT exists and what the relevance there is for this year. So we can come back to that again if we have to, but I feel like most of our listeners anyway, would know our thoughts on it. And the TLDR of it is that it's kind of a necessary evil for this year, I think.
And I think for next year too, but to answer your question, yes. I think it was basically Toyota versus Le Mans, because I don't even think it was Toyota versus the rest. It was, I mean, I guess obviously it would be if they both crashed, you know, something happened to them. But yeah, I mean, this was just a test between whether or not Toyota could actually finish Le Mans. But credit to them throughout the entire thing. They did what they would have probably have been doing, maybe not to the extreme level as if a Porsche or an Audi were there, but they seem to be on it, you know, pretty consistently. Now, how much pace was left in for all of their test sessions and leading up to practice that we'll talk about is remains to be, obviously, we don't know. But from what I could see, yeah, it was definitely Toyota versus Le Mans.
Yeah, pretty much. And then, you know, it came race day, and race day was actually a beautiful day on the Saturday. Great clear skies above, and we're all excited and hyped and ready for the start of the race, and everyone was gridded up for the Le Mans start, and everyone was ready to head off in the formation lap, and we started off in the formation lap, and then there was one car that was left behind. what a way to start the race.
Mm-hmm. You'll have that happen, but, you know.
And of course, out of everyone, it had to be the Collins car. It just had to be the Collins car.
At least it wasn't smoking. I mean,
that's a good point, but it did still spin out on the warm-up lap. Like,
yeah, guys. Yeah, that too. That was cold tires and
probably a fair dose of nerves as well and adrenaline after having the car not start on the grid.
Oh yeah, yeah, and just the woes that they've had at Le Mans previously too. I'm sure just this is it kind of thing. So.
Yeah,
but they recovered though, so credit to them.
And I think the best part about that entire thing was that Kiwi immediately made the bet that that car wouldn't be running at the end of the first hour, and when it was, he had to down an entire bottle of olives, including the brine water that they were in. So Kiwi, thank you for sharing that beautiful memory and beautiful moment with us.
Hey, yeah, his pain is our gain.
That's one way of putting it. But anyway, the actual, finally, when we actually got to the start of the race, it was, pretty well what we expected from the prototypes. The Toyotas started to pull away from the field, but the GT cars, my God, the GT cars, like, they just can't stop putting on a show when they get wrapped together like that. I mean, at one point you had, three Porsches, three Fords, both BMWs, and both Corvettes, and a bunch of the Ferraris, just nose to tail, bumping and barging, and just basically turning it into like a 24-hour sprint race.
Oh, there's first one of those in this podcast here. But yeah, absolutely. It felt like a 2-hour, almost like GT race at Macau, in a sense where they were just kind of like, you needed track position because you didn't know if a safety car was going to come out and that was going to be it. They were going to win the race. And it was like, the amount of times I saw contact at Arnage and like coming through just some of the silver corners where they were just beating and banging each other was just like, man, okay, that's all right. Some more of this, please.
Oh, hell yeah. And it was fantastic to watch everyone just sort of dig into it. And I think one of the moments that we had where we had a BMW try to go around the outside of a Ford into Arnage and they're bumping wheels side to side. And I think that moment brought us probably one of the best parts of the post Le Mans or even during Le Mans fanfare. The big Beamer meme. Wow.
I think this is like the first official like Le Mans meme or like WC meme that I've seen. Like, I mean, obviously we have Sky Active and all that stuff with IMSA and Rooftop Ray and all that stuff. So,
and
I mean,
also
like,
Tracy Crone spinning, but
Tracy Crone spinning, but that's kind of just like wherever he's at. Like this is a, this is a pure WC Le Mans meme. And I'm so proud of it. It's just taken to every single height I've ever imagined it could go. And it's so wonderful.
It's beautiful, isn't it? And I think the best part about it is it's just not been confined to the racing circles that we have both like on Reddit and around just other parts of the internet. Like my sister's boyfriend, he's pretty big into cars, but from like a street car standpoint. And about a week after the Le Mans race, he was like, dude, have you seen this? He just sends me a page full of big Beamer memes. And I'm like, oh, mate. Well, how are you hearing about this? What?
Yes, exactly. No, that was the same with a couple of other people. I've seen them like share some of the, just a couple of pictures that they're just like what is being like, and again, it's all topical conversations about, you know, BMW always having big vehicles and that kind of stuff. But still, it's absolutely hilarious. I just saw one, I think it was today that was posted, I think on the, some NASCAR forum or whatever that was for, or was it on RWC that had a BMW superimposed in NASCAR?
Yeah.
So competing against the large stock cars, it's just like doing burnouts in the front stretch while like like Kyle Larson's giving an interview because he finished second to it or something like that. It's just, oh my God, the whole thing is just amazing.
It's just brilliant. I think one of my favorites is one of them's being like really put. It's a quote. It's on the Circle Jerk sub. The title is, it really puts into perspective how small the LMP cars are. And so you've got a size comparison between the TSO50, the Porsche 911 RSR, a Ford Raptor truck, and then just superposed in the background behind like a skyline is just the BMW just taking up the entire background.
That's no moon.
It's brilliant.
It's not going to stop either. And like, I can't wait to get to like Road Atlanta potentially like later this year if possible, and maybe bring some signage along. I think we need to start making some banners.
Yeah, specifically, get on it. Absolutely, get on it. Yep. And there was a conversation about model cars on the subreddit, and this was brilliant. Someone commented, I picked up a 1 to 64 size model of the BMW M8. The interior is really nice and plush to sit in.
The detail is exquisite.
It's brilliant. I love the fact that this has happened, because it's just one of the beautiful parts of Le Mans. But anyway, there was also a race happening, right?
Well, right, yeah. LMP2, I think was at this point was pretty much being led by the 26. Started pretty near the front and were doing pretty well. I would say Oreca, for the most part, for this race was still pretty well the fastest chassis.
Yep, I'd still agree with that. But they did have a significant challenge. We'll talk about that later. But one of the first things about the LMP2 class that really kind of broke it open was the problems for the JCDC car early on the race, especially that huge puncher coming down the Mulsanne straight out of Turche Rouge. It basically blew the entire front right-hand side of the car, sorry, the front left-hand side of the car, just completely to bits, and like threw bodywork everywhere. The tire carcass is just flown off, and it was very lucky, in fact, that he did it in between two marshal posts, because otherwise there was a likelihood that a marshal could have actually been impacted by some of that debris, because I mean it just went everywhere, and like it's so great that it didn't happen like in the middle of Turche Rouge as well, because that car would have just gone straight into the barriers, and you could just hear the collective thoughts or the collective hopes and dreams of all the people who predicted that car to do well and everyone who picked it for the fantasy WEC competition just die in an instant.
Yeah, it never did enough for as much as we hoped and dreamed that it could from the JCDC. I think I might have had that picked.
I had that picked for the fantasy WEC.
Oh, okay, so you had it in fantasy. Oh,
yeah. Not a good time.
How many points?
They ended up finishing sixth, so not too bad, but I definitely could have made better value picks. And I think everyone else could as well. So we had a safety car to clean that up, and then it was a few moments later when the safety car had withdrawn and the first round of cars trying to get through slower class traffic, and we had the first proper big incident of the Le Mans 24. We had the Collers car try to wrap around the outside of the GTM Porsches through the exit of the Porsche curves, and there just wasn't enough room. Two cars were going for the same space, and the Collers car just was bang straight into the wall. And, you know, doing what Collers does, it caught fire, of course. But it put them out of the race, I think, about just after 4 hours in, and really broke the race up from that point, because not only did it bring out a safety car again, but what it did do, which was very important, is that it split a lot of the battles up, because... And of course, you know, we were worried for, I think it was, who was in the car at that point? Dominic Kreiheimer, maybe? He got out of the car and he was fine, and that was great, because it was a pretty hefty impact. But importantly for the scope of the race, the 92 car, the Pink Pig, had just pitted before that, and thus didn't have to pit within the safety car regulations, so didn't lose about a minute and a half on track. And that very much had a massive effect on the way that the race kind of traveled on from there, didn't it?
Yeah, we definitely saw the safety car pretty much break up the GTE battle that we had going on in terms of the overall battle. It definitely swayed LMP2, I believe, too, if I'm not mistaken. There was a few cars that got caught up on that. So yeah, it's a question of whether or not, because I almost want to say it's a BOP issue if we have too many safety cars and there is not enough a gap difference or pace difference between any of these cars that they cannot naturally make the gap back up, which we definitely saw that to be apparent in GT Pro for a while. It kind of snowballed after that. But still, I just, this is definitely where I think a lot of the excitement of the first few hours kind of died down a bit in terms of the overall standing.
Yeah.
I mean, for each class.
Yeah, maybe not the overall for the race, but definitely in GTE, we'd been treated to such a pressure cooker of battles in that early part of the race. But because the 92 were lucky enough to have made that stop already, I've got in the notes here, they got a free kick. They were able to, get a minute and a half gap for free. And with what you said, the BOP being as tight as it was, especially for the top 4 to 5 cars in that class, you know, excluding Aston Martin, because who knows what happened with Aston Martin. No one was able to bridge that gap. And I think it's less of a problem with the BOP, in my opinion, and more so with the limited strategy options that the class had enforced on it this year. And I think that's the much bigger problem overall in terms of, you know, why the GTE battle was a bit stale, is because the strategy in the pits and the freedom with what the teams could do was so severely limited that all the cars were on a homogenous path towards the finish, and it just meant that there was no variance within the race. At least that's my view.
No, I think you're right. It had a complete lack of strategy or flexibility for strategy for the GTE teams, and even for other teams as well, locked in from the other classes. They were essentially locked into stint lengths. They were locked into fuel allotment, almost like pit times. Like there's no ability for anybody to have a distinct advantage. And as much as we rag on Ford for having sandbags, they have a very fuel efficient car. It's very slippery down the straights, designed for Le Mans. Like that car is going to be faster than a lot of other cars. And for them to basically not have any ability to flex any reasons that they built that car for anything. Granted, right, it's all supposed to be BOP and they're all supposed to be even, but you're not even giving them the ability to try to save fuel, because that's an advantage. So we have to take that away. So realistically, all of these cars are now going to run the same speed. And if one of them just gets lucky and there's no way for anybody else to redeem that throughout the rest of the race, he's just won the race based on luck. And like, that's rather annoying.
Yeah. Well, okay, we said that there was little flexibility and was little variance, but why exactly has that come about?
I would say trying to create a show. I'm not sure. There was definitely the combined fueling and tire changes that were done this year were literally done because of the excitement value. That's what the ACO had said. So that aspect of making a longer pit stop, making it safer, that wasn't a thing they wanted to.
Introducing variants into strategy?
Right. But then you have, at the same time, they still have to come in at the same time. So like, I don't know. Are they saying like, you have to get it done faster? You have to fuel faster? Like, are you waiting on fuel? It doesn't matter about fuel at this point. They all run the same amount. So like, are you saying that they should all be as efficient as possible so they don't need as much fuel? Like, where is the incentive for somebody to get an advantage here? Other than just, okay, make the most neutral car you can and get the best drivers you possibly can and basically get the best BOP and good luck.
Yeah, good luck. I think not only is the driver change, the fuel and tires at the same time thing really just one of the stupidest ideas that the ACO has ever had in terms of, you know, doing it for the show. Because, you know, it's endurance racing. Everything's meant to take a long time. But I think the two things that really kind of ticked me off about it was the lazy man's BOP by mandating a maximum stint length and minimum fuel time. Like, that's just laziness from the regulations, the people who draft the regulations, because it leaves absolutely no room for a team to try and push the envelope for an advantage. And I'm not saying that there needs to, I'm not saying that, pushing for an advantage is something that every team should be looking to do, but it means like, if you have a car that is efficient enough to be able to go an extra lap, then you should be able to fight to be able to do that, because it's a strategy option that you can then take. And the minimum fueling times is just, it's just stupid.
Yeah. So let me expand on this a bit. I think the ACO too. Yeah, I think you're right. I think the ACO and FIA are overreacting to what they've seen in LMP1 has been, oh, well, you know, it's not going to be as good as it was in previous years. We've got to make this like the best year we possibly can, you know,
for GT. Yeah.
Right, for GT. And it's just almost like they're selling this, they're like doubling down on this, like, okay, well, it was so close last year. Remember last year's finish? Oh, remember last year's finish? Oh, remember like, and so I feel like they're like, okay, well, we need to make sure that this class is going to be even, so we have the capability of having three manufacturers competing on the last lap for the win. Like, we don't. In LMP1, this year proved it. Like, I don't think we lost a lot of fans because of the finish this year from Le Mans in LMP1. I think there was enough storylines and there was enough just understanding that, you know, things are going to happen where a car is going to finish a couple laps ahead of another car and nobody's going to freak out about it. Nobody's going to say, oh, that was a bad race. And I think the ACO and the FIA are just strangling this class by going, if a GTE Pro car finishes plus two laps or plus three laps and just walks away with it from a GTE 1 year, then it's, we've got a bad class. I don't think that. I don't think that that should be a thing. I think that there should be a way for teams to approach Le Mans that gives them the opportunity to win, not just going, well, we'll see when we get there based on BOP and based on how neutral the car is. Yeah. Like, I really want that back in that class. Yeah. I really do.
And another thing that really ticked me off about that, about these pit regulations, about, you know, minimum fuel times and, you know, that sort of things, is that it entirely discounts the work that the crew does throughout a 24-hour race. And, you know, you look to last year, part of the reason that, like, for example, the rebellions in LMP2 were in the race towards the end of it were because of the work of the crew to be able to put that car into a position. Like, admittedly, they dehomologated the bodywork, so it was all for naught in the end. But, you know, they were ingenious enough to try and, you know, MacGyver a solution to a problem that they had. As I said, it was a DNF in the a disqualification in the end, so it doesn't matter. But, you know, it completely nullifies, you know, training a good crew to be able to do these jobs efficiently to try and gain an advantage. And I mean, like, even think back further to 2008 with Audi, like, they spent, it's part of Truth in 24, they spent a ton of time just practicing pit stops and variations in pit stops, because that they knew that they would get that sort of thing from get that sort of thing in the race, and if that happened, they could use that to their advantage. With mandated stint lengths and with mandated minimum fuel times, you don't get any of that. The crew's just there to, you know, service the car within the time limit, and then they're off. It just, it annoys me so much.
It's very neutered, and it's surprising that we're going down this route that, I mean, the spot 24 is going down, and there's so much criticism with that. I just don't see where the positive is in this outside of, well, we're going to take a plausible advantage that somebody can have that you can't gain away from them so we can make it more even. And it's just like, well, can they kind of, I mean, it doesn't have to be where everybody has to be on the same lap on the final lap. Like, that's not how racing works, and you're not going to be able to dictate that. I feel like they're trying to be able to control the weather at this point. And I don't understand it. And they're not explaining it either, which is really frustrating.
That's even worse. But enough about that. I think we've talked that to death now. And
my stick is now dead from my horse.
From beating your horse too hard. phrasing? Are we still doing phrasing? So yeah, the 92 was never captured. It would go on to win the race by a lap in the end. And it kind of took the wind out of what was a fantastic start from GTE Pro.
The battles still in GT Pro for the rest of the class though were fantastic.
Yes.
17 pro lineup race cars on the same track. for 24 hours, you're always having battles somewhere. And it ended up being like that for literally until the end of the race. It was great. It
did make me very happy, though, in parts of the race.
Yeah.
But yes. The next big major thing after Nightfall was a big accident at the Porsche curves for the number 17, the S&P Racing Dallara. So I think it was Matevis Izakian in the car at the time. Another big accident for him in that Dallara. But it didn't seem so bad from the initial viewing of the accident until we actually saw the damage in the rear of the car and the bodywork of the car, which the stewards or the marshals at that post actually got him to disassemble so that way he could try and get it back to the pits. And it took him a good 20 minutes at that marshal post of, you know, removing bodywork and trying to get the car into a position where it would be able to function again. And he did try to take off in the end and basically ground the engine into a fiery pit of mud. poor dude. He worked on that for so hard for so long, and to have it basically all go up in flames and steam was a little disheartening, and especially after the difficulties that the S&P crew had already had at that point. But I wanted to talk to you. I wanted to ask your opinion about the adjustments to the Porsche curves, because they were controversial throughout the test. They were controversial throughout the race. And I don't actually think it did anything to reduce the number of accidents or the severity of accidents at that corner. What were your thoughts?
The severity of accidents, I'm probably going to have to agree with you, because we haven't seen yet what would happen if a LMP2 or 1 loses a tire. Like a left rear tire, heading on that left hander before the long right sweeper. Because we've seen how many of those LMP cars just absolutely take flight. So I don't know if they've added enough runoff on the back part to be able to compensate for it. However, it's definitely saved some cars from going out of the race. So from that aspect, I don't kind of mind it. I don't know if I'm becoming into like, oh, like I want walls there so that people die. But I definitely don't like that. And this is just conflicting, because I think there's also on the other side where they're driving faster because there's no wall there anymore. There's definitely I don't really want to hit this, or like, I don't want to risk this, because if I make a mistake, I'm going to end up in that wall immediately. Yep. Like, there's not even a question. So I'm not going to try on the outside, or I'm not going to try to take this as fast as. So they're taking a lot more risk, and you're seeing a lot more cars go off there. I don't know. It's definitely causing more kind of slow zones around there too, with all the gravel that's getting brushed up. So it's making my argument for gravel traps really awful, because they're disrupting the race.
Well, but I actually think that if they put a gravel trap there instead of the asphalt runoff, it would have been better. So my issue with the adjustment of the Porsche curves is like, okay, you want to be safety conscious. You want to have runoff. You want to make sure that the cars are going to be safe if they go wide of that corner. That's fine. But the problem with asphalt is that it is only effective if a car is running wide under control. So like, if a car, you know, turns in on the apex, the rear end steps out, the driver catches it and is able to coast through the runoff. That is the situation in which that kind of runoff, that super high grippy asphalt is acceptable. Because it's basically just like running through a dirty car park, and then you come back onto the track, scrub your tires, and you're fine. The thing that I really found distressed me about the Porsche curves this year was the fact that the amount of cars that we saw go through that area sideways was much, much more than we've seen in years past. Like, I can't remember any. I don't think last year that we had any car actually go sideways into the wall at the Porsche curves. We had one or two go sideways on the change of direction from left into karting to the right and end up in the gravel trap. But, you know, that's what the gravel trap's there for. But, you know, Izakian in the 17, Ben Hanley in the number 10. I think there was also the 37, number 40, the G-Drive Graf car went straight on after sliding out. You know, the Labra car, the 82.
They slid even before they got to that left hander.
Yeah, and he hit the concrete. Yeah. Like, if you're going to have a concrete wall there and you're going to have tire barriers for some of it, you need to tire barrier the entire thing, because that hit that I think Paul de Resta had late in the race, where he went straight into the concrete, That's not acceptable. And the cars going sideways through there is not acceptable, because what it did was it punctured all four tires because of how grippy the asphalt was. So I think that section needs a rethink. And I think that if you're going to have runoff there, it needs to be gravel. It needs to be gravel because it needs to arrest the cars before they either get back onto the circuit or before they hit the wall. And you're not going to do that if a car is sideways. If your car is sideways and they're going over grippy asphalt, you're just going to rip the tires to shreds and it's not going to slow the car down. And we saw that. We saw that with Azakian. We saw that with Hanley. We saw that with a bunch of the other guys who went in there sideways.
See, okay, so my thing would be, I definitely need safer barriers there.
They have safer barriers in the middle section of that track. No, that corner.
They just, I don't think they thought that they were going to get an angle like that. And definitely looking at Paul DiResta's crash, he definitely caught it where they didn't suspect it. But next year, they'll definitely have safer barriers there. I do think that, I will disagree in terms of, well, it'll be tough. I would like to see kind of like some actual hard data between just the friction totals of you locking your tires, sliding sideways. So you have, you know, basically moment, you know, you're punching a huge hole, in the air, flying sideways on gravel versus asphalt. I definitely think cars do slow down because of the tarmac aspect and the tires are just sticky. And if you're basically locking them up, you're burning through all that rubber, and that rubber is being used up by trying to like hold on to the ground. So I do think asphalt does help slow cars down. Now, maybe a combination of having a little bit of asphalt or like asphalt and then a little bit of gravel so that you're kind of going into the gravel and sinking in the gravel, but then hitting asphalt underneath. I think that's a good combination to do. Mm. But you're right. That these cars are getting really bad angles when they're hitting the wall that they never used to have before. I mean, they would have huge crashes. I remember Jan Magnussen's crash where he basically...
That was the one that I was thinking of, yeah.
Where, I mean, even, you know, there was nothing for him to do and he just went right into the wall like that. So that's a hard impact anyway. But these are just like even crazier angles and they're hitting the wall at a ton.
See, I think if Jan Magnussen had that same accident now... with the runoff that was there, he would have been fine because the asphalt was there to save him. But
or the impact would not have been chassis ending, and he would not have had concussion protocol. Was that or no? He was fine for the race.
But the car wasn't. But the thing is, people weren't having that accident anymore because they were pushing to the point where if you were going to have that accident, it was going to be way earlier in the corner. And that's why we saw Paul DiResta go straight on, because they had the quote unquote safety net of having that asphalt there, which meant that if a car was going to go off, they're not going to go off in the same way that they were previously, because they're trying to push through the corner in a different way, if that makes sense.
No, yeah, no, I agree. They're attacking it differently because there is a different level of risk to it, the risk has changed. And so I think this is just the natural cause of what you do to when you change a corner like that, or at least where you change the how you punish drivers for their mistakes at that corner. You're going to see them take more risks knowing that they can just slide through and be okay, or that they're not going to potentially ruin their day if they go at 101% through that. So it'll remain to be seen, because again, they're pushing, and that's what I'm saying, is that we've yet to see one of those LMP one or two cars lose it in the basically have the back end come out while still staying on that track and getting air underneath and getting it lifted. Because I still don't trust that those cars are okay to have that kind of aero change and not flip over still. They've done it every single time we've seen it.
So yeah, like Marc Genet and Loic Duval in years past.
Yep. And I think there might have been another one in a previous year too, but I can't remember. That did not get filmed or anything like that. Yep. I swear there was another one there too. But yeah, that's where I'm at with that. So sort of agree with you, but I do think that from a safety aspect, I mean, they're hitting the wall at less speeds. That's good. They need more safer barriers. But that's good too. It's good to see safer barriers there. But beyond that, the track, the return onto track too, we saw a couple cars that slid into the gravel, then slid back across the track pretty much from, the apex, the natural apex of that corner all the way off into, track left. So yep. That's not good. No. So
it definitely needs to be looked at. Look, I am one of the proponents of, enjoying a track that has consequence for mistake. And it's just a matter of trying to calibrate that consequence with the nature of the mistake. But I think if they do want to have runoff there, they need to rethink how it is currently. And if they do want to have concrete walls there, they really need to rethink about having something in front of the concrete walls. Because Port Arrest's impact, man, it jarred me from sitting friggin' all across the other half of the world. It jarred me in my chair. Like, that was how bad it was.
NASCAR has seen some pretty nasty hits like that on concrete walls, so I'm pretty used to hits like that. And it's a testament though to those tubs and that they're able to withstand that. And you can definitely see where the modern technology is on and a lot of the safety mechanisms that, I mean, even if there isn't that safer barrier that's already absorbing the impact, you have the carbon fiber, and then you also have a lot of the crash structure around the driver too, with the foam padding and all that other stuff. So it's good to see him really not have any issues with such a huge hit on that wall.
Yeah, and it was good to see because we saw a lot of cars go off, as I mentioned. Ben Hanley, 37 car, the 40 car, the 82, the 50, the 22, and the 90 all found their way off in that section of the track. I think that very much leads me into my next point, and that was that similar to what we had last year, we saw a quite high level of attrition in LMP1. You could probably say this year that we were expecting a higher level of attrition, what with the privateers, being at their first Le Mans with the upped equivalence technology, giving them more power and more fuel to use, and therefore a higher load on the equipment, gearbox, and the engine, etc., etc. But still, to have, I think it was 4 or 5 LMP1 cars out of the 12, or sorry, the 10, make it to the finish. Only really 3 of which without major sort of significant issues. It kind of harkens back to what we had last year with such a problem in LMP1. But we all got it wrong, didn't we? Well, I mean, not me, but everyone else in our preview podcast, you guys all got it wrong. You guys all saying that Rebellion was going to be the one that was going to have issues out of all the LMP1s. But of everyone...
I thought Rebellion was going to be okay.
We'll have to go back and check. If someone remembers and can go back and check, let us know. But I feel like maybe not just you, but I think it was Trovosaurus and Kiwi Chris and a few other people said that of the LMP1s, they were expecting the most problems for Rebellions, and they were expecting S&Ps to get to the finish.
No, I don't know why I would have ever said that. That doesn't make any sense. Rebellion have done this for years. That's a noob claim to make. So I hope that was not me. So
we'll go back
for official review. So it's under investigation by the stewards.
Yeah. But there was, the one of the generators, expired out in the circuit. The other one had a multitude of problems, but was still classified. Let's not forget. I'll come back to that in a second. Both Rebellion cars, were slowed. One of them had a penalty or two for driver time or some stint length infractions, which was dumb. And then one of them had extended repairs in the pits. Two of the three BR1 Dallaras, ended up in the wall at the Porsche curves. We already mentioned that with Azakian and with Ben Hanley. The other one had a engine issue or a sensor issue within the first hour and basically spent 3 or 4 hours in the pits, which wasn't great. But when it came back out on circuit, it was setting some crazy good lap times, which was really impressive until it expired in the last hour of the race. And, Collers did Collers things. It was... I don't want to say surprising, but it was a little, I guess, deflating, I think. Would you agree?
Yeah, sort of. That's just Le Mans. So I'm just used to that kind of stuff. I don't know. I wouldn't say super deflating. Why would you say deflating?
So the thing that was deflating for me is that I wanted there to be some level of tension for Toyota. I wanted there to be a car maybe two or three laps back, coming in towards the last 3 or 4 hours of the race, that meant that they had to keep pushing and to, you know, be tense in that garage and tense for us as fans, because otherwise it would have become, and it eventually did become, just a bit of a cruise towards the end.
Okay.
And
can I say where you would have needed to have that happen?
Where would
the
I
scenario have in
that
which
happen?
Yeah, the scenario in which you would have needed that to happen is the LMP1 privateers would have actually had to have some overall advantage over the Toyota hybrid team. They in terms of stint length, in terms of overall pace, in terms of overall top speed, in terms of something. They needed some variable. Actually, they needed a majority of variables. They just needed one at this point in order to actually have them have any realistic shot of doing anything. Even if the Rebellion for two laps was faster than a Toyota, there's no where in God's name are they going to have pace for the next, you know, 300 laps.
386.
Right. So that scenario for everybody, I think we all didn't want to expect it, but we really just should have, you know, that kind of thing. And I think really that's really what it came down to, is that there was no shot for the Rebellions to do anything outside of if the Toyotas broke. And really watching LMP1 was really, it was just Toyota versus Le Mans and whether or not their hybrid was going to be okay. They were going to be able to manage everything all right, which you would assume if they're pushing at 90%, which seemed like they're going faster, but I don't know. My expectations for this were just, right. Yeah.
They had the luxury of being able to, if they needed to, just, you know.
I'm not going to fault anybody for getting upset about it too. Like, I mean, it's definitely within your right to be disappointed or deflated. I get, yeah, that's a good word. Deflated, yeah. Overall for the remainder of the race. Cause it definitely wasn't anything to write home about outside of just following along with Fernando's hero stints and Nakajima putting in work and all that stuff. So, and then the penalties at late in the race.
That was the next thing I was going to make a point about. Toyota weren't perfect. Like, maybe their cars were reliable for a change and they had a lot of pace and their, you know, pit stops were clean and that was fine, but they weren't perfect. They made a lot of mistakes in terms of their driving standards, you know, speeding in slow zones, you know, exiting under safety car and, you know, really like elementary level stuff. Especially from Buemi. Buemi had a shocking race, to be real. They had Kobayashi miss the pit lane on their pits, on their pit stop, which meant that he had to do an entire lap on basically a hybrid power / slow zone limit. And then they got penalized for exceeding their fuel usage for that stint. And, you know, these things, if someone had been close, not necessarily like there, but like somewhere within the next five laps, it would have meant that there would have been at least some sort of tension. But really, it was just nothing in the end. And that was what was deflating to me, because I wanted Toyota to earn it in the moment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, right. No, I agree too. I think they'll be around for 2020. And I think if they do win it that year, or if they win it in 2021, that will probably be the year where I'll be a lot more emotional and that kind of, just where it's, you know, where it's truly like they've managed to now beat Le Mans, but they've also been able to beat everybody else. And like, that's the toughest combo. I mean, like, you can go out there and basically just run your own race. They basically were in their own class for the entire race. So it was whether or not they could finish the race. You know, and they did. So congratulations. But you're right. I mean, there is a level of, you know, inevitability for this, and that, like, don't feel too high about this. This wasn't really that earned, that you can't really deny. I mean, outside of, you know, when Audi was there, but they had already earned their Le Mans wins. So yeah, it was basically just like, hey, they're just proving themselves again and again and again. What are you going
to
do about it?
And then they continue to earn them again by facing the likes of Peugeot and the likes of Toyota and then the likes of Porsche even towards the very end. They continue to earn that.
Right, and it's... Right. And I totally agree. So I think, I really hope next year the privateers do keep developing, and hopefully the package freeze that Toyota have on them is actually going to start showing the privateers to be faster in some parts and to start getting advantages. Because I mean, we can't, I'll be the first to say we can't have another race that we had this year. I think this year was fine because Toyota hadn't won it. And I think the storyline enough overall was that Toyota finally winning it. And obviously Fernando winning, you know, the part two of the Triple Crown, is a big deal, but next year's not going to have that storyline. So you can't use that again. So you have to make this a lot more even. You have to give privateers some advantage here.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So we moved on to Daybreak. We moved on to Dawn on the Sunday. And we kind of missed out on our classic, what's it called? Happy Hour. We kind of missed out on Happy Hour because the track was extremely overcast in the morning, which meant that you didn't really get that beautiful bring up of the track temp that sort of brings the lap times up with it, which is a bit of a shame. But what we did see was that we saw the class leaders consolidated at that point. I think there was a comment that, I think it was, Graham Goodwin or, it was either Graham Goodwin or Alec Manish said on air that at this point in the race, towards the end of the race, that the class leaders hadn't changed since 5 a.m., that day. So the class leaders at that point were properly consolidated in their positions. And then we were looking towards just the last segment of the race, and then a grate came up at Terre Rouge. Just pop, hello. big heavy metal grate at the edge of Terre Rouge just sort of broke from its welds and popped itself up, and it wreaked a bit of havoc, which resulted in a slow zone followed by a safety car to enable the crew to weld that back down. I think the safety car went for about 25, 30 minutes, or even longer. And then a full hour and a half of slow zone after that to allow the weld to sort of set before cars could start driving over it again. Is that the craziest thing you've ever seen on a racetrack?
I was at a race where a canopy ended up blowing out onto the track, and then we rode a safety car for that. So
I forgot about that.
And that was this year. So that is that's definitely up there. That's definitely up there. We've seen it happen at other street venues where they're using surface roads. So why not here? But that is crazy that they've had that in there for so long. Le Mans never seen that. That's the first time I've ever seen it at Le Mans happen. So, wow. Yeah.
It was pretty and, dumb. And
another long, long, long safety car. And
then slow zone as well afterwards. So the next 40 minutes had that. Well, I think it was the next hour actually had that slow zone at that section to move cars away from that. The only other time I can think of something like that happening on a racetrack was when the turn two at Bathurst actually started breaking up and coming apart, and they did some running repairs in the middle of the race and red flagged the race. And that was the only other thing I can remember from of something like that crazy having to be done in the middle of a race to repair the track.
I don't know if we could start taking ideas on what to do, but maybe to have something where you're still using a slow zone where they're going slow, but you have some form of like mobile lightweight barrier that at least the drivers have to be absolutely ridiculous to even drive into it, you know, in order to get near the repair workers so that they can at least do this without. But I mean, again, that took such a long time to repair, but it's just, I feel like these just to have that for almost, you know, for a good 1/24th, I guess, of the race. It was just really frustrating as a fan. You're like, all right, this definitely doesn't feel like they're racing. They're just, racing for 90% of the track, and then 10%, they're just, you know, waving to fans. Yep. So,
yeah, come on. We to get going again. Come on, please. Let's go, please. That's kind of how it felt. Although the best part about that was it came at a perfect time for me to actually go make some food and like have a shower and feel humid again after being up for 20 hours straight at that point.
So 24-hour races will give that to you. So this was kind of one of those 24-hour race deals where you get a little break in between the action.
You're
so,
able to just, you know, take a step back and just sort of refresh. And one thing it did refresh was the
GTE battle. My God.
Yeah, exactly. all of a sudden, it sort of seemed out of nowhere that Sebastian Bourdais was right on the tail of Frederick Makovicki, and we had one of the battles of the race, to be honest, and there was position swapping back and forth. You know, Bourdais would get out of a corner good and take the lead, and then Mako would, you know, dive deep under braking and take it again. And we saw what you might be able to call aggressive defending from Makovicki. Some might say over-aggressive defending from Frederick Makovicki. And it did cause a lot of controversy, both in the commentary booths, in the chat, and around the world, I expect. What were your thoughts on that sort of battle and, you know, the respect on track from each driver? Or lack of?
I think it's a racing incident, and as a racer, you just log that. You remember that for the next time. And you maybe run him a little bit harder, or if you were going to give him a little bit of room and you know it's him, you don't the next time. So I don't think there's anything that was egregious with it. I think, you know, it is a little bit dirty, but I think there's no punishment that would be worthy for a little bit of dirty driving in that sense. I think if there's contact and, you know, people are in the wall, there's, you know, that kind of stuff where there, you know, then I can see more of an actual, you know, punishment in that storm, or even giving the place back. Like, I don't know. I liked what I saw, you know, from the battle, and the way he concluded it was a little bit aggressive, but overall, I thought it was pretty good. I really enjoyed the overall bout. So
yeah, I'm going to be very biased here as a Porsche fan, but I was kind of okay with it. There was one moment where I was like, I think it was when they exited the second chicane and the Mako just kind of swung wide and then kept swinging wide. And then you could argue that he was moving over for the LMP2 car coming up. This is just a bit kind of, but you know, that's racing. It wasn't too long ago that we had, you know, bump passes be acceptable, and, you know, Porsches firing Corvettes, well, Porsche and Corvettes firing into each other at the last lap of Laguna Seca and stuff like that. So, you know, you kind of have to take it on the chin sometimes, I think. It's all part and parcel of, you know, being a race driver.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and some drivers are going to take a little bit more than they're going to give at some point. And that was the point where he took a lot more than I guess everybody was thinking he was going to. But, there's a little bit of me as just in terms of just doing sim racing, that kind of stuff, where you're like, okay, that's a little, like, I don't, like, I would be like, you have the opportunity to still take that lead. I'm not, unless the Porsche had a top speed advantage, which I thought the Fords were a little bit faster than the top end, but not sure anyway.
It was interesting because it seemed that the Fords, I can't really work it out. It looked like the Fords had a better drive out of the corners, except when it was in front. When it was in front, it had no drive out of corners, but it also seemed that the Porsche had a little bit of a top speed advantage at that point in the race. It was real weird. I couldn't quite work it out at the time.
It didn't make any sense when I think there was a couple of discussions about it too. Like, people were just not sure what it meant, because it didn't make any sense from where that they were making pace, because you would see them be able to they would just have top end speed, and I would have just assumed that was just naturally everywhere, but then they didn't in other like parts where they just couldn't get around one of the Porsches for a while too, and you were like, I don't know why they're not sailing past him. So it was weird how the pace kind of shifted in between, and maybe it was just a balance thing, and now GTE is just pure balance. It's not even overall anything else. It's just the overall balance of the car, neutral balance all the way, and that literally affects everything. Exit speed, corner entry speed, top speed, I don't know. Like, it's strange.
It does produce some good racing for us, though. I do very much like
love
this GTE touring car class that we've got now. Because that's what it feels like.
It is, honestly. It feels a little like late 90s BTCC racing, where it's just, everybody's shoving on each other a little bit, and And there's, but, and they just battle all the way through the entire start and finish of the race, and everybody's competitive at some point throughout the year. So,
or it's we'll like see. Modern day V8 supercars, which I feel like the BMW would slot straight in. It's about that size.
Right. Yeah. That thing. Well, that, yeah, only it's, well, what is it? Bathurst is two BMWs wide on some parts of that track. So
maybe a BMW and a half.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, what am I saying? It's half a BMW.
That was the last real sort of exclamation point coming in towards the end of the race. It did sort of fizzle out towards the end. The Porsche was able to pull away again, and we did end up with a formation finish for the Toyota factory team, Toyota Gazoo Racing, with the number 8 taking victory over the number 7. Finally, breaking the 25-year, I guess you can call it a curse now. The curse has been broken.
I don't know. I'm assuming Hugh Dishanak was over in Rebellion or something, probably, because he's more involved with that than he is with Toyota now, or that they kicked him out or something. I really would have liked to see him, his face, man. I mean, he has worn the emotions of that team for how many years, and to finally see, you know, his outfit that, you know, helps run that team finally win, you know, that overall victory. I mean, his Sebring win was emotional. I can't imagine what he was feeling, you know, when they finally won that. So yeah, the entire race was just kind of, there was kind of an inevitability to it if Toyota could hold on. And I mean, you know, even if they incurred problems, you know, they could still probably push pretty hard to catch up to whatever. And I mean, all the privateers dropped. So there's some inevitability to it, but man, once that checkered flag waved, it was definitely a unique feeling. I've never, you know, it's been one thing rooting for Tom Christensen and for Audi and all that.
What's it like being a winner?
I mean, I've rooted for Audi in the past. Tom Christensen's one of my favorite drivers. So I've seen him win, you know, and so I've had some affinity with the Audi team, but they've just been dominant. And I've really, since I've been paying attention, they've been, you know, they were the main empire. So. Yeah, to see finally this team that took on the Empire and to take on basically Porsche, which became the Empire, and all these other guys, and finally win it is awesome. It's been way too long time coming. So,
do you enjoy that bottle of champagne?
I did. Yeah,
you crack it 5 minutes before the end this year.
No, I couldn't even get it until like an hour later because the store wasn't open. So unfortunately, but that was a good call because otherwise I probably might have been tempted to open it early, and who would have known.
And then
I'm glad for both of us though I brought up Fernando once in this entire conversation, and that was a big deal throughout the entire last like 3 hours of the broadcast was Alonso. And I mean, realistically, Alonso, I mean, in our comments coming up, I'll probably allude more to it, is, I mean, he definitely played a huge part in this win. So,
yeah.
And that was big too, to see all the post-race shenanigans was great too.
Yeah. I kind of have been talking around Fernando Alonso because I feel like he's been talked about enough, maybe. But it was...
He deserves a few talking points from that race, man. He does.
And let's give him those now. So the first thing I want to say is that his stint during the night was the most consistent and the best paced stint of the entire race from anyone. And if you look at the Alcomel system, like, results for lap-by-lap analysis, you can just see, like, 320.1, 320.1, 320.1, 320.1, 320. He spent like an hour and a half in the low 320s during the middle of the night, and no one else was getting close to him. Like in the other car, I think it was Jose Maria Lopez, and he was doing like 22s or something like that. It was just phenomenal how consistent Fernando was during that race. And in fact, he was the best of the Toyota drivers.
Yep. I've seen a few breakdowns from you know, some of the guys that are on the sub as well, as and some other official sites that just kind of go into more detail about the average stint length and just how consistent he was based on the other drivers through traffic and all this other stuff. And I mean, it stands out. I mean, he was just brilliant at, you know, in the night stint. So I mean, you know, that was impressive to me because I didn't think we would really get to see a lot of that because he didn't need to. I mean, there was no real need to, outside of just wanting to catch back up to the number 7, which he just reeled them in like I've never seen in what, 3 or 4 stints.
Yeah. It was akin to
great.
it was akin to Nick Tandy in 2016, where he was just an absolute machine, just replicating the same lap after lap after lap and just pulling everyone away. It was basically like that, but, you know, Spanish.
Or 2015, I think, right?
Yes. Yes, sorry.
That was, Hulkenberg. Yeah. That was with Hulkenberg. Yeah. But yeah, no, that was my point that I wanted to make too, is that was where I thought he absolutely excelled in. And for better or for worse, that 8 car seemed to be the faster of the car for the entire weekend, whether or not that was intentional or not. Those drivers ended up running faster laps than the other ones. And, I don't know if that says anything. If Anthony Davidson would have been able to do the same thing, I think he would have. Now, would it have been, would we have been talking about Anthony Davidson's hero since that night? Probably not. But I think it's well deserved, in terms of what he did and where, what position they could put him in and all that. Now, it should be a competitive race. It should have been, but
yeah. And
what can you do?
Yeah. And on the plus side, it did bring a lot of publicity towards the event, a lot of publicity towards us as a community in the subreddit, which was mostly welcome, but it did also put on a lot of, I guess, pressure for the event to sort of stand up, and maybe it didn't. And this is going to come off as a bit dickish, but the worst part about Alonso being in this edition of Le Mans was the subpar reporting from some of the wider motorsport community, especially the F1 community and F1 reporting sites, on the intricacies of the event. And like, this is going to sound quite elitist, but there is just a special nuance to endurance racing over things like Formula One and over shorter racing. There is just a lot of, you know, keeping up with the story and how it evolves and understanding, you know, there is politics at play and we have to kind of accept that, and, you know, things like BOP and the equivalence of technology and that sort of stuff. But some of the ways that it was reported from outside of the sports car community really put a lot of pressure on the users of the subreddit to sort of be like, no, this is how it actually translates, and this is what these sort of things actually means. Especially regarding the equivalence technology, there was one particular article that basically construed the EOT regulations in such a way to throw out this tagline of, oh, if the privateers go faster than the Toyotas at any point, they're getting a penalty. It's just like, no, hang on, that's not quite right. And there's a lot of context about that. Was one of the things that annoyed me. But on the other hand, there was just a lot of publicity. And for someone who comes off as sometimes quite brash and quite abrasive in the F1 paddock, Fernando Alonso was, even just like on the cameras and through radio interviews, he was just so happy to be there and so supportive of his team. And I especially remember that after Nakajima scored pole, he was all about like making sure everyone knew that it was Nakajima who did everything about that lap and Alonso that did nothing. And I found that very, very wholesome of him.
Very, very wholesome. There was some WC wholesome shared in the whole event. So it was great to see his camaraderie with the team and all that, and it looked genuine, so I'm happy. I'm still trying to find a Toyota Gazoo racing flag. That is, I don't understand. I don't know where they get all these flags. I can't find anybody.
If any of our listeners has a hookup for a Toyota Gazoo racing flag, Cookie Monster FL, just hit him up. Just hook him up.
I have currency. I'll even give you gold bars if you want gold bars. I'll convert this to whatever the equivalent of gold is and send it to you.
Bitcoin. No, don't do that.
Dogecoin.
Oh, no.
Oh, even worse.
Anyway, but the end of the 24 hours wasn't actually the end of the drama. So we'll just go through the initial results, just for completeness. So it was the 8 from the 7 from the 3 Rebellion. The only other LMP1 cars who were classified were the number 1 and, as we mentioned, the number 5 Ginetta. Just a quick note on that. How about Ginetta doing
they what made it.
Nissan and Aston Martin could not do and get a car classified as a finisher for LMP1 in their right? first race? In their first race.
They're not. Hey, Ginetta isn't bad. It's not a bad. I think it needs so much more dev work, and hopefully they get the funding to do it, but The Manor boys did it. They got it through. And I just think that just shows the quality of the racing outfit behind the name of the team or whatever. I think Manor is leagues above, the Nissan crew and, the Aston Martin crews that had to service as P1s. But man, I mean, that's a big accomplishment for how little track time that car had.
Absolutely. So that's pretty impressive. And they had a faster lap than the Bicolas car. So that's
and by, they've done something Bicolas has never been able to do.
Oh, that sounds so
still on their first try. Unbelievable.
That's pretty cool.
Great job.
We'll skip LMP2 and we'll go down to GTE Pro. So the 92 Porsche, one from the 91, one from the 68. So Porsche, Ford, and then the Corvette, AF Corsa, Ferrari, the 52. So props to, I think it was Chris who said that the 52 would be the leading Ferrari. I didn't believe it at the time, but all the other ones shot themselves in the foot constantly. So congratulations to Chris. Unfortunately, we had three retirees in that car, the 64 Corvette racing car, the number 82 BMW, who suffered, I think it was engine problems overnight, and the number 94 Porsche, which I think broke the suspension heading into Mulsan, and then, yeah, just couldn't be repaired for the rest of the race.
Mentai had a terrible, Core had a terrible, terrible race. Yeah, that was, they wore Le Mans on their shoulders pretty heavily. That was a rough one for him.
Yeah, and especially contrasted to how well Manti handled everything. It was just, and I mean, the 93 car was, it just seemed like it was in the gravel every single minute or every single lap in the practice sessions. And then, of course, there was that big accident for the 94 heading into Indianapolis, which required a chassis replacement. So, yeah, Core didn't have the cleanest Le Mans. And then in GTEM, it was the number 77 Dempsey Proton car, followed by the number 54 Spirit of Race. So the Giancarlo Fisichella, Thomas Floor, Francesco Casalacci car. Congratulations to them. And followed up by fan favorite, number 85 Keating Motorsports Ferrari. So two Ferraris on the podium in GTEM, which was really cool. Unfortunately, neither of the Astons finished in that class, which was a real shame. And the other Dempsey Proton Porsche was another non-finisher from a good position at that time as well. But you know what's cool about that? About the number 77 winning?
That's Patrick Dempsey's first GTM win as an owner.
Hey! I mean, yes, that. I mean, at Le Mans as well. But if you consider class wins as well, we had an Australian Triple Crown this year. Yeah.
that's right.
I just had to throw that in there.
Yeah, well, you know, it's good. You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
Australia.
You Australians are so good.
Hell.
Slow down.
Yeah, mate.
Let us keep up.
But finally, we'll round back up to LMP2 because quite a lot happened after the flag in LMP2. So the initial winners were the number 26 G-Drive TDS car of Rusinov, Roman Rusinov,
Pizzatola,
Andrea Pizzatola, and John-Eric Verne, followed by the Cinatec Alpine team of Lapierre, Thierrier, and Negrao.
Negrao, yeah.
And then the other TDS racing car, the 28 of Vassevier, Emmanuel Collard, Francois Perrotto and Loic Duval. What came out after the race was that the number 26 and the number 28, the two TDS cars, had made modifications to the homologated fuel flow sensors in the pit lane, the fuel line, which enabled them to exceed the mandated fuel flow regulation by about 5 to 6 seconds at some points, I think it was, which basically gifted them the win, let's be real. Like, that sort of advantage in the pits is just ridiculous. So both the 26 and the 28 were straight up disqualified from the results. Damn!
Oh, yeah, don't be dicks. There you go.
Yeah, pretty much.
So that's all I have to say about that. If they want to keep, you know, they got caught, so don't do it again. And if you want to cry, you know, throw a fit about it, then you can go play somewhere else. I mean, I'd rather see guys up there that are competing that aren't making modifications to stuff that they don't need to. I understand that you're trying to find an advantage, but dude, I mean,
you're breaking the tech regs. You're just breaking the tech regs.
You're like legit breaking tech regs. This isn't like a, oh, well, you know, like something randomly fell on our tires and they became more grippy for five laps. Like, I don't know, like this something stupid of the max.
This isn't a, we spent, you know, many, many hours moving the blocking inside the fuel tank to try and optimize the fuel flow and found something that was worked well for us.
That is within regulations.
Mm. And we still got penalized for it.
Touch stuff. Yeah. Like this is so just clear cut. And it stinks that this has to happen in which we basically have a podium that doesn't, but there's no way to really have this checked yet. I mean, that this is a thing that needed to be scrutinized, that doesn't take 15 minutes after, in park fermé after the race is over. So, it's just one of those deals with racing that you're going to have these potential dudes that are going to try to pull this shit. So,
And I think
none of it.
Yeah, it was pretty disappointing. But on the other hand, hell yeah for Alpine, right? That's Nicolas Lapierre's third consecutive LMP2 win. The only year, excluding last year, of course, where he didn't race in LMP2. But the two previous years, both with Alpine, he won the LMP2 class, which is friggin' awesome for him.
Looks like Mike was right.
And MJ Dumoulin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
DPI wins them all.
Yeah, DPI to Le Mans and wins, right?
Right. Is it not?
No, it's not.
It's not an Acura. They didn't put like a 3 foot little like span of carbon fiber right between the left and right wheel fenders and the nose of the car.
Cookie, shut up before I slap you. No,
they have the Alpine badge on the front of the car. It's basically an Alpine. They call it an Alpine A470. I should be able to order one on the showroom floor at this point. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Just accept that it's Frenchies being French? Anyway, the person I'm most excited for is Pierre Thierry. I love the fact that Pierre Thierry, as an actual silver driver, has gone ahead and been a part of the Le Mans winning team. I think that is so cool. So friggin' hats off to Pierre Thierry.
I wish we could have seen him on the podium. That would have been great to see him like hoist that trophy on the top step. Yeah. But yes, that was a great win for him. Definitely.
Yeah. But on that note, some very interesting data has come out from the FIA Alcamel Systems page that has been analyzed by none other than David Hannemeyer Hansen, of all people. What it shows is that using the classic measure of endurance racing lap speed, the top 20% lap average, for the entire LMP2 field, the third best driver of all of them was silver-rated Andrea Pizzatolo.
Well, that seems valid and
fair.
nothing to see here.
It's just like it is just a bit poo that we can have quote unquote silvers, amateur drivers, be the third fastest car out of a field, including like half a dozen ex Formula One drivers, some former Audi LMP1 talent, and some of the best sports car drivers going around. It just makes no sense.
I see the argument for it and against it, and the argument against it, in terms of changing the driver ratings to something that's more representative of actual silver or amateur drivers just becomes less and less valid because it's just, we're getting to the point where are we deciphering in between what is an amateur and a pro driver? I think I think the whole gentleman aspect is getting, like you applied as almost like don't worry about it. They're gentleman drivers. And it's like, no. Are they amateur drivers or are they pro drivers? Could they, if they stopped doing their day job, could they basically be professional race car drivers? If the answer is yes, then I don't think they're amateur drivers. I think they're professional drivers. They just don't have the schedule and they do other things outside of racing, which race car drivers can do. They don't have to just do racing. If they want to, they can go work at a ice cream parlor shop.
That's weird. Would totally buy ice cream from an LMP1 driver just quietly.
Right.
Anyway.
Oh yeah. Andre Loiter selling ice cream.
Oh. Give me right. that.
I would ask him lots of questions.
Yeah.
while serving my ice cream. But yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's just like I would assume now we should definitely go. Yeah, that he's not an am, right? He's no, definitely not.
He's an up and coming GP2 driver. Like.
Right.
Like half the former silver field in that. So, okay, the question I want to pose then is, what is the driver rating system trying to achieve? Is it trying to differentiate between amateurs and professionals? Is it trying to differentiate between people of different skill levels? Is it trying to differentiate between older and younger drivers? Or is it trying to give you a basis of an expected lap speed for a particular class of driver?
I think it's a little bit of all of those. Like, I mean, I think it started out that way where it was like, you know, where it is supposed to differentiate the all pro lineups with the more fly by night operations that run a lot on the budget of the amateur driver that races for them and whatnot. And that usually back in the 70s and 80s and even in the 90s that the amateur drivers were just really amateur and that there was a huge gap between a professional race car driver, you know, and even an amateur who sometimes didn't even take Skip Barber's racing school. Like, you know, they would literally come in with almost no experience whatsoever and literally drive these cars, you know, and you would see that huge pace difference. And so now I think we're getting to the point where, not only do you have amateur drivers, gentleman drivers, which I've been just talking about, that, you know, are coming in with much more experience or much more, or have the ability to get a lot of experience and get a lot of talent development, you know, before they enter, but then you also have actual drivers or series that actually develop drivers, which we never really had in the 70s or 80s. That was really concrete. Yeah. And you saw those bleed into these series. So I really think we need to have a separate class and it should just be for up and coming, like almost feeder series, F1 or open wheel feeder series classification for a specific driver under the age of something that he's kind of what he's like,
or she.
That follows their trajectory. And kind of goes, okay, you look to be upcoming or whatever, that you've done this and this and this and you've progressed, whatever. We're applying this tag to you. And so either you can fill that pro, there's like a two pro lineup. There's like a dedicated pro. There's like a pro slash feeder series guy. And then there's an amateur guy.
That's actually a fantastic idea.
Right. And so then you have an amateur there who has to be a dedicated basic amateur who can't just be a feeder series like junior driver. You have the ability to put a pro driver in, so a former F1 driver or a feeder series driver like Lando Norris. And then you have a dedicated, basically pro driver. He can't be a feeder series driver. He has to be a pro driver. Yeah. And then you have that, or you can make both of them have feeder series tags on them, but make a separate tag for this so that we can start working on what an amateur is instead of going, well, an amateur could be a Lando Norris. No, he's not. Like, well, I know Lando Norris is an exception now, but I mean, I'm saying like a GP3 driver, I would not consider him the same as a Tracy Crone. Like,
nah. Well, I mean, Tracy Crone's rated bronze anyway.
Bronze,
an Andrea Pizzatolo versus a David Hennemeyer Hansen.
Right. Yes. Exactly. The guy. Yeah. Right. And thank God for David for getting all this data too. I mean, like this dude breaks down a lot of crazy racing stuff. Mm. On his downtime. So I appreciate that, David.
Mm. And like, I had a bit of a discussion with David Hennemeyer Hansen on Twitter about this, and something that he sort of picked on as well was this sort of up and coming driver talent, especially in GTE-AM. He kind of made the point about like the likes of Julian Andlauer and Matteo Cairoli. I mean, Matteo Cairoli is no longer rated a silver, but he was in the past. And, you know, Julian Andlauer is silver rated, and you know, those sort of level of guys that are definitely not amateurs but are still young enough and still inexperienced enough to not have that gold rating applied to them. And he was kind of making the point that, like, you know, these aren't true amateurs, and why are they allowed to race as an amateur in an amateur class? And it does pose an interesting question. Because,
or just kick all of them to gold. I mean, like, if they hit a certain feeder series that's designated, they're just automatically gold. Even if they're 18 years old and still making a ton of mistakes, then that's the decision that these teams have to make, and going, well, we can have a really fast driver, but he makes a lot of mistakes. Or instead of just giving them an out and going, well, we should just use him as a silver, and we can basically go, you know how to drive a race car professionally. We want you to take it easy for like four stints in this entire race, and we'll have the pros do the rest. And there you go. Then you win the race. Like, make it tougher on these teams to have to decide on overall pace versus performance versus, you know, make it tougher. It's just like, I feel like they gave these guys a huge out in terms of, you know, having to worry about how fast they're their worst driver is, yeah, kind of thing, right?
But then I want to pose a question about, you know, the likes of other silver rated drivers that we see sometimes in IMSA and in this race specifically. You look at Catherine Legg, you look at Christina Nielsen, you look at, in this particular race, Alex Davison. You know, these sort of guys are professional race drivers. At least that's where they earn their money. I wouldn't say that Catherine Legg or Christina Nielsen is an amateur driver, but they're rated as silver because you can sort of expect, maybe not anymore, but there was a time where, you know, you would expect like a silver rating sort of pace from them. And like Alex Davison, for example, maybe you don't, not as familiar with Alex Davison as what I am, but he was a former V8 Supercars driver. He's a V8 Supercars podium winner. He's a V8 Supercars pole position winner. I feel like he may be even a V8 Supercars race winner. So he raced in V8 Supercars for like 7 or 8 years. And, you know, he's now rated as a silver driver, but he also won the Australian Porsche Carrera Cup by miles and miles and miles a few years ago. But he's rated as a silver driver because he hasn't done anything internationally that has elevated him to that gold rating. But he's not an amateur. He's a professional race driver. So where, what sort of level do you put, slot those in? Do you need like a 6-tier system for all of these sort of drivers, or how do you fit?
I mean,
all these
it's got to be accrued on experience. I mean, like I just don't see, if you race in V8 Supercars for 7 years, how long until you do not remember how to drive a race car? Like, is there a progression of fall off between, you know, from a former race car driver to an active race car driver? Yes, absolutely. But is it to the question where they are dropping down? And so like the difference between a silver and a gold is there's a lot of stuff that's the difference between what we classify as silver and a gold, like in between an amateur and a pro. Like that's a lot of differences in terms of how you understand racing, how you interact with race car drivers, like
your race profession.
Right, your racecraft in general is just expected and is much higher because of the experience you previously had. So it's almost like we're not taking experience into matter at all. We're literally just looking at your like the last couple lap times, achievements in the last couple of years, almost still too. Like if you are winning everything, all of a sudden you get bumped up to gold because you're winning everything. And it's that, well, that's how it, I believe it used to be like that. I don't know how it's working now, but. It needs a refinement and it needs some attention to it. And I feel like we've been calling for this for like 3 years and it has had no attention to it whatsoever. And I just don't understand at what point we're going to get to it where we need to actually address this. So, driver ratings, absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
What are they good for?
Absolutely nothing. So we talked about GDI penalty, we talked about driver ratings, talked about Junetta making it to the finish. Just before we move on, I want to make a big, big, big shout out to one of the LMP2 teams we put in as a dark horse for the race, the Panos Barthez Motorsport car, which was Timothy Bure, Julian Canal, and Will Stevens. Up until the very last throws of the race, they were one of the top teams in the race. They were doing so fantastically well, representing Ligier in a field full of Orica's, and they were right up there with the very front of the field, and I'm trying to see where they actually fell apart. I feel like it was late in the race. So they were in the top, they were second with 6 hours left. Right at the end of the race, they ran into problems and couldn't make it towards the finish in their top position, which was a real shame. But I want to just make mention of that. Big shout out to them. They were the stars of the show towards the end of the race and, well, throughout most of the race. And it was quite distressing. Well, maybe not distressing, but it was kind of crap that they missed out like they did. Makes me sad.
Oh, yeah. I feel for your sadness. They were so close, but alas. Oh, and shout out to Tracy Crone for not finishing again.
Oh,
weirdo.
Poor Crone.
They did spin out a couple times. I think somebody had mentioned that he had spun out, and then I think I saw like an hour later he spun out. So that was – shout out to whoever said that too.
Yeah.
The shots. Get my shout outs in. Apparently I saw some Hero of the Storm podcast, or not podcast, what's happening? We're on a podcast, a stream. And apparently, like, they would interview all whoever won, like, the some player. And they're like, all right, so get your shout outs in now, like, at the end of the interview. And he would be like, oh, all right, cool. All right, shout outs, man. And he would literally go for like 30 seconds to listing all of these shout outs.
Yeah. So, shout out to everyone who was in voice chat throughout the race. Shout out to the people in the scratch pad document.
And I'm old. Stop it.
And shout out to me for getting every single class prediction correct. Yeah, that's right. I actually got some good predictions in for a change. Ugh. And somehow I couldn't translate that into a winning fantasy WEC because I'm shit.
Well, and the 26 gods.
No, I actually picked the 36 for the win, remember?
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah, right. Sorry, I forgot that, yeah, you had picked... you went Alpine and I made a fuss about that. Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah, so, and then just also mention that GTM, that was the closest fight at the end. Everybody else was separated by one lap plus, and GTM was still, Spirit of Race was still on the lead lap, I believe. That was the
yes, a full minute and 39 seconds off the pace, which is fine.
GTM was uneventful, but it was a close race.
Yeah. So coming to this point, coming to basically the very end of things, I have a question for you, Cookie. Was this Le Mans a classic Le Mans?
No.
Do Toyota care?
Yeah, for marketing purposes. I don't know anymore. But yeah, this one definitely cared.
Well, do they care that it's not a classic? Do they care that it wasn't necessarily the best race?
I'm gonna say no. But when they win it again with competition, they're gonna say yes.
Okay. Does it matter? Does it matter that if it was a good race or not?
Well, we're all fans. So we want to see the sport do well, and if we perceive anything to be potentially bad for it, we don't want to have that happen again. So, it does matter because this is definitely one of the lower, I would say, rated races that you could see for Le Mans, and I would think to just kind of store this in your memory banks in terms of okay, well, you know, this is kind of where it can go. Outside of being super competitive and to almost kind of flex your, well, what else can we look about in this race muscles? But I don't know. Beyond that, I think it shouldn't matter because this is endurance racing. It's 24 hours. What do you, the expectation should not be that every car is on the lead lap like IMSA. Like it's not, that is not our expectation for endurance racing. I don't think it should be.
I'm glad that you said that because I definitely agree, and it's something that I was kind of contending within myself throughout the race. It's like, does it actually matter whether or not this is a good race if it ends up being, you know, a decent event? And I think, you know, I say this all the time. We've been spoiled, especially in the last few years, with the level of competitiveness throughout the field, and I think we fooled ourselves, or the ACO tried to fool us into fooling ourselves, or I think the general thought was that we were going to try and believe that we could maintain the same standard of competitiveness and the same standard of interest and the same standard of close racing with an LMP1 field that was as fractured and as unbalanced as it was. And I'm not talking about unbalances on pace, which it was to an extent, well, to a large extent, let's be real here, but unbalanced in the fact of, like, you know, you had a seven-year-long campaigner versus, you know, a bunch of first-year upstarts, you know, and collars. It kind of... I've used that word deflated before, but I didn't think I would feel as deflated as I did throughout the race, because I think cumulatively as a community, we all set our expectations too high. A part of that was because the ACO tried to manufacture things like, you know, the GTM the GT regulations in terms of stint lengths and EOT and that sort of stuff to try and make it feel closer. Yeah.
Yeah, the EOT was not explained well at all, and I realistically what I, and that's why I wanted when we were talking about the entry lists and whatnot, I really wanted to bring up that FI technical director, and he basically laid out what their plan was. But again, it's just that's not being talked about, in which it's that this year was not going to be the private series year at all. They were not going to have pace. They want the hybrids to go an extra lap. Next year will be where the development curve hopefully hits, where that they're a lot more even. They probably will have advantage on the Toyotas at some point. So I think that's where it's going to get to. And I just, that was never discussed and I never talked about it and it never went up. And I just don't understand why that wasn't discussed further, because that was, yeah. I mean, I think people just legitimately thought the Rebellions and SMPs were going to actually be vying with the Toyotas, battling it out. Like, and it never was even close to that. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely was deflating compared to what I remember from literally the last like 5 years, but I don't know. It's, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's definitely unknown territory. We've just never had this where we've only had one manufacturer basically guaranteed to win. So it's really kind of tough to watch if you're a racing fan, 'cause you want competition. So they shouldn't be an offshore boat race where there's like one boat winning everything. Like, and there's no other boats in it. Which is where they are right now. Yeah. So.
It did kind of feel a little hollow, and I'm sure that in the weeks and years to come, people will kind of look back on this race as a kind of like, oh yeah, that was that year. Which you can kind of expect, I think. It definitely wasn't the best Le Mans in recent memory. But there was an article that DSC posted, basically a Graham Goodwin editorial, talking about the 10 things that need thinking about again for Le Mans. And it goes through things like the EOT and balance performance and communication from the regulations makers on why they've made these changes, blah blah blah. But I want to read out one specific excerpt from this article. This is talking about just after talking about the issues in GTE balancing and the hard maximum of stint lengths and that sort of thing. Here's the quote. "Add all of the above listed so far, stir in a good measure of new pit stop regulations induced to, quote, improve the show, but in reality, removing a major component beloved by a major population of the fan base and competing teams, and the race in 2018 was missing some of the essential flavor of endurance racing in general and Le Mans in particular." And I think that is the crux of all of the issues that we've spoken about today and all of the issues that everyone's discussed over the past few weeks. It feels like the show was being manipulated to the point where it was sterile and, homogenous instead of having all of this variation and all of these different things going on and all that sort of stuff. And I think, yeah, it was missing, as Graham Goodwin put it, the essential flavor of endurance racing. Because it did turn a lot of the race into a series of sprints. And I mean, you could say that with the reliability and pace of endurance racing nowadays, an endurance race isn't a series of sprints, but it can be made to not feel like that with varying strategy and varying, ideas of gaining pace and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, I feel like that's something that needs to be looked at for next year to make sure that we bring that flavor back into Le Mans and we bring that,
Bring equivalence back. Bring balance back. These are supposed to be, it's supposed to be a balance of performance, but not a neutering of performance. It's supposed to be, it's supposed to be equivalence of technology, not,
advantage of
false,
technology.
right? Advantage of technology, which it turned out to be. I mean, equivalence of technology to me makes it sound like, okay, well, we're going to balance all technologies out to be even. Where EOT in this regard was, well, we're going to balance everything so that the hybrids have +1 lap per fuel every stint. And,
Three
and they
seconds a
have
lap advantage.
+5 seconds per pit stop. That wasn't equal. Like, it's equal in terms of, I guess, how much money Toyota have put in versus S&P and Rebellion, but that's not equal in terms of on track value, which is all racing was supposed to be anyway. And Le Mans is supposed to be challenging these teams on an equal footing to be able to compete against each other for 24 hours on a track that is really tough to tame, really tough to handle. And we didn't see any of that from the front. We just basically saw, well, this is how the regulations were stacked, and there was no ability for us to compete, which is why I sympathize with a lot of the privateer drivers, even though a lot of their points were just pointing out like, oh, we can't compete at all with the Toyota. But it's like, yes, we get that. Talk about why that it's the regular. I mean, I guess they're not going to throw ACO on the bus, but I mean, like,
if Alonso was in one of the privateer teams, he would have thrown the ACO under the bus.
Well, yeah, Jensen didn't say too much either, but that needs to be addressed for next year. You've got to have it to be equal, or the privateers have to show some advantage somewhere. And because right now, how are you supposed to get excited about any of this? They really should just, I mean, talk about DPI versus LMP2. This needs to just be LMP1H and LMP1P. Like, it just does not need to be anything other than that at this point, because they're on two different classes.
Yeah.
As far as I'm.
Yeah. And I definitely agree. And this is something that needs to be looked at, especially for next year. Because if we run into next year with the same problems, facing the same issues, and get the same results.
No, it won't be. It won't be. This, I guarantee the privateers are going to be faster.
Fingers crossed, mate. Fingers crossed.
Guarantee those privateers.
Because.
So it'll just be hopefully equal.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Oh, man.
But I guess that brings us to the end.
Yeah, right? I'll still say, though, I think for all the negatives that we can say about this, I think the ACO have accrued enough equity to have afforded this kind of a crappy Le Mans, you know, in previous years, where that they could pull this off once and get away with it. I don't think that they have the luxury to be able to pull it off next year in the same manner. Like you said, they've got to get some, it's got to be different. Otherwise they're going to feel it. And, or the 2020 regs better be so great. And the news about the entrance better be so fantastic that we don't even care about next year. We just care about 2020. Otherwise I'm going to be talking about it. So that's for sure.
Well, I feel like that's almost the point where I'm at the moment. With the way that this season's shaping up. And that's a really bad thing to say, because I still do believe in this championship, and I still do believe in the racing that we have in it. But it's kind of fallen apart in front of our eyes at the moment.
And I don't know what to...
But I hope they bring it back. Like, I hope they bring it back in for Silverstone, but like...
I was afraid of this happening.
Huh?
Until you see that EOT change, it's not going to change. And that's where I've been at since basically Spa. I mean, ever since we got out of the prologue and there wasn't a whole lot of changes, and they even nerfed the LMP privateers a bit. It was like, how are you even expecting them to be faster than the LMP1s or the faster than the Toyotas? And it's that they made it perfectly clear early on that they were not to exceed the Toyota's speed overall. And it's like, okay, fine. I get where your logic comes from, but from an overall fan standpoint, that looks awful. So where are your optics here that makes that make any sense to a race fan? It makes sense to a sponsor. It makes sense to the people that you're getting money from, I guess, and trying to pitch this sport to. But for the guys that actually show up to this, it doesn't really make it feel any great. So yeah, I mean, this is more boardroom win than a whole lot of other stuff, but hopefully next year we'll cease that.
I'm not sure if I said it already in previous episodes, but I actually hoped that Toyota would pull out this year and not race this year without any competitors. And we just saw just a five-way privateer scrap at the front of attrition and like privateer teams and like garage Easters basically trying to win Le Mans again for a year or two and then bring it back with the 2020-2021 regulations. I wish that had happened. But that's not the universe that we live in. So
that's okay. I'll still take a Toyota Le Mans win. I'll wait till 2020 when we start beating actual competition and
then celebrate it. Celebrate.
Yeah, and then, dude, I will smack talk the absolute shit out of anybody if we actually start beating OEMs. Don't you worry. Oh, then I'll feel good about that.
Okay. And on that note, at least we can end with a positive. On that note, I feel like it's time to end the show. Thank you very much for joining me, Cookie.
Gazoo?
Not quite yet. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you again very shortly. We'll have a few episodes in the near future, one dedicated to all the IMSA action that we've had in the last
What
few
a race.
Weeks.
What a race.
Yeah. Oh. We'll get to that. We'll get to that next episode. We also have coming up in the next month a preview for the 24 Hours of Spa, the next edition of GT3 Quarterly with Chris and Chris. And a look ahead to the ELMS rounds at the A1 ring, or the Red Bull ring, sorry, the Red Bull ring, and then the WC ELMS doubleheader at Silverstone. So stay tuned for that. Thanks for being patient with us, and we'll see you again soon. Peace out.
Gazoo! Toyota win the Ma! Gazoo! That IMSA race, though, oh my god, that was probably one of my favorite endurance races of the year so far.
That last stint with freaking Simpson and Dumas flying up the field.
And then who was being cheeky in the, was that Montoya? I knew Montoya's going to be cheeky. I told you, dude, I swear to god, dude, he's not going to make friends out there. I cannot wait for somebody to call him out and let's see what happens.
I'd love to see Montoya try to hip check Andre Lotterer, and then Lotterer just come out afterwards and just be like, no, that guy's a f***ing idiot.
's finger guns.
Nice job. Okay. I thought you were kissing the air.
Oh, yeah. I guess you could say that. Yeah. Well, that's weird.